It's Monday, October 2nd, 2023. From Peachfish Productions, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The government shutdown. It wasn't just in the offing. It wasn't, what's the phrase I quoted last week, a foregone conclusion. No, there was a different word for it, a word often liberally applied, a word that hung over the proceedings. A bit of a harbinger, if you will. I don't know else how to put it except to say,
amid the chaos of a looming shutdown,
and as this dark cloud of the shutdown looms over the district,
the looming government shutdown as well.
Made a looming government shutdown.
The government shutdown looms.
It loomed. You heard me inveigh against doomerism. You hear that all the time. But this was loomerism. But as you know, all the gloom and doom and loom came a bit too soon. There's now a continuing resolution. Doesn't solve things. Nothing will ever be solved. But it addresses the situation quite well in the short term. And we are told by the end of the week, either Kevin McCarthy is going to be ousted, not a terrible outcome, or Kevin McCarthy's tormentors will be rebuffed, which is also a development I could live with. Mike Lawler, bona fide Republican congressman, true conservative, New York, one in a very close district, not afraid to name names.
There's only one person to blame for any potential government shutdown, and that's Matt Gaetz. He's not a conservative Republican, he's a charlatan.
Charlatan though he may be, he is in the spotlight, which in his personal Gaetzian process of photosynthesis he uses to sustain life. Ah, Matt Gaetz, you glib, bouffanted, possibly indicted scamp. I do want to point out, there is one show out there that didn't overwhelm you by the possibility of a shutdown. You know that, right? One show without segment after segment over what will it mean and how will it happen and are there any charlatans involved? And that's the Gist difference. I'm not going to say that we knew it wouldn't happen. I really did think it might happen. But what kind of looming doom was going to be the value add that I would bring to you? Sure, a news you could use item about which national parks are going to be open when, you'd find that elsewhere. Really, there's a lot of interesting things in the world, but government shutdown? Stupid. Pointless, politically asinine, unproductive, and we all understood this. We all understood the machinations. We all understood the motivations. We all understood the 20-something radical Republicans who really don't like Kevin McCarthy. If that wasn't being reported elsewhere, I'd have reported it here. But we get it. And in this case, we didn't get it, meaning the shutdown. And let me tell you, I am happy to have not brought you the news. On the show today, Donald Trump's unusual legal strategy of calling for his judge's disbarment. But first, Jill Filipovich is an author and a CNN columnist covering everything from women's rights to foreign politics. She recently wrote a feature in The Atlantic titled, "I Was Wrong About Trigger Warnings." Has the national obsession with trauma done real damage to teen girls? The subhead asked. Yeah, usually a yes when a subhead asks such questions. This left me with several questions about trigger warnings. Questions I will ask of Jill Filipovich, because she is up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of The Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Jill Filipovich is one of our most essential writers and thinkers. She writes on Substack. She has written for The Guardian and CNN. And in The Atlantic, she wrote an article, "I Was Wrong About Trigger Warnings," was the headline. "Has the national obsession with trauma done real damage to teen girls?" Her Substack had a slightly different headline, which I do think gets at more of the point she was trying to make. "Progressives need resilient social movements. Resilient social movements need resilient people." Let's talk to Jill about it. Welcome back to The Gist.
Thanks for having me back.
So this was a little bit about trigger warnings. You don't ignore trigger warnings, but to you, trigger warnings were somewhere between an annoyance and a symbol of something that's wrong with social movements, right?
Yeah, that's right. I know the headline in The Atlantic was about trigger warnings, and the piece starts out with an anecdote about trigger warnings. But what I'm fundamentally much more interested in is this question of how we build progressive movements that are effective, and how we make sure that we're able to talk about trauma and the traumas that people live in ways that reflect the reality of how trauma works, which is that most people who experience traumatic events are not, you know, permanently leveled by them, and that emphasizes our ability to persevere.
Well, I'll go beyond that. Many events that are called trauma or maybe are seen as trauma or we're led to believe are trauma needn't be felt as trauma.
That's right. And, you know, I think part of this is like a poverty of language problem, right? We have this word trauma that we use to describe a huge range of adverse events, only a tiny fraction of which, you know, are actually kind of understood to cause or even potentially cause PTSD. And so that word trauma is used, I mean, including by me, right, in a lot of my past writing, as a way to emphasize that this is really, really bad, even though it may not actually be traumatic. And I think by kind of over-labeling adverse events as trauma, we then interpret them as such. And that can have really negative mental health outcomes.
Well, I don't think it's a poverty of language. I think there are plenty of alternative phrases. I think it's a conscious effort on the people who want to advance the idea that so much is trauma and some of their intentions are good and some of their intentions are hoping to get an outcome. But the trigger warning itself stands alone and a little bit apart from what you're saying overall about trauma. So let's get into that. I mean, the reason The Atlantic put trigger warning in the headline is it's almost a photo negative of what a trigger warning is supposed to do. Instead of warning you away from a topic, it did attract a lot of attention. It did attract us to this topic. So there's something, I think, a little bit of a frisson of danger just talking about trigger warnings.
I think that that is right. You know, the concept of trigger warnings are also really divisive, right? There are a lot of people for whom the idea of trigger warnings itself suggests, you know, liberal baby snowflakes who can't handle any adversity and who get very upset at the concept of trigger warnings to begin with. And then there are a lot of folks, you know, who share kind of my politics, who are tired of this debate on trigger warnings, who think that it's distraction, that it's, you know, just kind of like a poking the bear effort, a way to get clicks and to rile people up. And I do think there's something to that. That said, I also think it is a reality that trigger warnings have gone from, you know, kind of a feminist blog space and into the academy, into college campuses, and now very much into progressive movements, onto podcasts. You know, when I listen to a variety of, you know, My Guilty Pleasure, which is true crime podcasts, there's now these kind of standard warnings at the beginning about, you know, all the potential things that this may bring up. And I guess it to me, the fact that these warnings have become so ubiquitous in so many different kinds of spaces does suggest that we should be thinking critically about them and asking, you know, do these help, do these hurt, or are they neutral?
Are you tired of the debate or tired of the critique?
That's an interesting question. I think a lot of the critiques of trigger warnings are not necessarily made out of a place of good faith and curiosity.
Yes, I agree. The podcast Triggernometry is not trying to do anything except dunk on the idea of trigger warnings. That's absolutely true. But let's take the best faith version of the critique. Do you think that, and I'll phrase it like, even if in some limited circumstances, and you acknowledge this in the piece, that there might be some benefit to warning a person that an unexpected content might come up, they're so vastly over-applied that they do more harm than good at worst and are just unnecessary and self-congratulatory at best.
Yeah, I think there's some really interesting research and some really useful critiques. I mean, some that I've certainly made of trigger warnings, which go beyond just like, oh, they're annoying and you're too sensitive, right? A lot of the research that I've at least seen and read suggests that trigger warnings can do more harm than good. They can raise a sense of anxiety rather than soothing that anxiety. And, you know, my concern, particularly in an academic setting, in a college setting, is that what trigger warnings are often being applied to are women's stories, the stories of people of color, the stories of marginalized groups, stories about racism, stories about discrimination. And to me, it creates this presumption that, you know, that the straight white male experience is the normal experience. And even when that experience involves things like war and death and tremendous trauma, but that the experience of, you know, all of the rest of us is other and a problem and something to be avoided because it's so upsetting. And I think when you carve out all of these stories, you know, of sexism and racism and abuse and the histories that women and other marginalized groups have experienced, you know, worldwide, and you put those in this separate category and you call it triggering, I think that does a great disservice. One of the ways that an expert I interviewed for the piece explained it, you know, is essentially all of us, if we are lucky to live long lives, right, all of us are going to face some really significant life setbacks and adversities. And if we strip away all of those kind of smaller stressors, all of those smaller adversities, we simply lack the ability to then deal with the really big, really significant stuff that comes down the pike.
In practical usage, do trigger warnings, maybe in a college class it's different, but as I read them as or hear them in de rigueur places like podcasts or every article in Jezebel, do they serve their stated purpose? We want to help you avoid something that might be troubling. Or, and this is my theory, maybe it's some of that, but it's an indication that you, the listener, the reader, are about to enter the sort of space sociologically where people believe in trigger warnings. It's telling and signaling people this is the sort of milieu that tells you and signals to you that we are your people and we share the same values.
Yeah, I do think that's right. Certainly, you know, as they operate on blogs and, you know, sort of issue or identity specific websites, which, look, I'm not sure is the worst thing in the world, right? I think every political tribe has a set of signifiers and language that they use to say, you know, you're coming into this particular kind of space. You know, and to me, the utility of trigger warnings really is, I mean, this is so unsatisfying, but it really is like, it depends, right? I think in some contexts, it does make sense to warn viewers, readers, listeners that this unexpected, sort of out of the day-to-day ordinary thing is going to show up. I think where it doesn't make sense is, for example, where the potentially triggering thing is captured in the headline of the news article or the topic of the podcast. You know, if I'm downloading a podcast about murder, I know there's going to be murder in it, right?
Might be a murder, yeah.
you know, so I think to me, it's part of it is a common sense thing. And, you know, part of it is also something that I think we all need to practice, which is shoring up a little more confidence in each other and, trusting our readers and listeners and viewers a little bit more, that they are adults and can probably handle even pretty challenging content.
There is something else, I think, going on, and it's hinted at in your Substack titled Progressives Need Resilient Social Movements, and in much of the text of the Atlantic piece, which is the language of the trigger warning is getting in the way of the progress we need to make. However, when you write, when anyone writes, even if they're a progressive and are advocating for social movements, they're doing it through writing. When anyone reads that, they're perhaps wanting some change in the world, but they're not actually engaging in a social movement. They're reading about it. When an online site puts in a trigger warning or just nods to this sort of way of looking at the world, they might say we stand for a movement, but really what they're doing is trying to get people to read the thing. And so I do think there is a tension between wanting actual change and wanting eyeballs and using and positing the idea of something exciting, upsetting, different might be contained in these pages. And so I do wonder about that. I do think that if we really want, or if you really want social movements, they're bad. But if what you want is people to pay attention to the thing you're writing about social movements, they might actually serve their purpose.
Sure. And I mean, look, publications have different goals than social movements, right? And that's a good thing. The goal of The Atlantic is certainly not to shore up progressive social movements, right? I don't think any editor at The Atlantic would say that that's what they're trying to do. I don't think they're trying to kneecap those movements either, but I think what they're doing is something quite distinct. Those lines get a little more blurred when we're talking, for example, about a feminist blog, right? Or something that is a publication that is in a particular issue space and advocating for a particular set of goals. I don't think it's a bad thing or a negative thing that media shares some overlap, right, with social justice movements, with social movements of any kind. But I think it's a good thing if media outlets are distinct and have distinct goals and strategies. What concerns me about the social movement piece of it is that I have seen a shift over the past few years of many young activists, I think, expecting, and I'm going to put this in like slightly harsher terms than perhaps I mean, but I can't think of a better way to put it, of expecting workplaces and movement spaces to be therapy spaces. Mm-hmm. And for social movements and progressive work, any workplace, frankly, college campuses, the places that they value on the internet, to be places that aren't just spaces of collective goals and collective action, but also spaces wherein each person kind of works out their individual sort of psychological issues. And that strikes me as tremendously unhealthy, both individually and also to these spaces that we care about.
It has struck me more and more, and maybe there are probably a lot of reasons for this, and the evolution of online writing kind of moving away from having a practical effect in the real world, and you could write for just smaller and smaller niches and make money at it if those niches are very enthusiastic and will pay you. The idea that everyone's narrowcasting, the death of the broadcast, throw that into it. But this is what strikes me. That there is a greater and greater gap between actually achieving something, a policy, and achieving attention writing about that policy. So if you were mayor, for instance, you may say that there has to be some sort of interdiction in terms of drug use or crime. Like, you'd have to do that. But if you wanted to get attention for what the policies of the mayor should be, it's a very narrow path to write the, look, we have to arrest some people who have guns. Or, look, I don't want to vilify addiction, but we have to have some decent policy. So what I'm saying is the gap between the social movement and the advocacy or writing about or championing a social movement is bigger than I remember it during my lifetime. What about you?
That's interesting. I don't think I have thought about it in those terms. I think by virtue of how we consume information now, we're getting much, 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 much more of it. That is probably a lot of this much lower quality, right? And so it makes sense to me that when we're talking about, you know, that connection between politics and policymakers, and then how that what they're doing or what they're advocating for is kind of getting filtered down to the rest of us, because that sort of noisy space in the middle is so much vaster and we're so much more connected to it, that would be bigger and that it would certainly at least feel bigger.
Yeah. To take another example, this wasn't even a Substack. You tweeted a couple months ago about raising the retirement age for guaranteed social security in order to...
Everyone got real mad.
Well, you tweeted about raising the retirement age to, you know, because our social security fund is in trouble, which is, I mean, if you look at the polls, if you tell people they're going to have to work longer to get less money, they don't like it. But, you know, good polling organizations like the University of Maryland have said that 75% of Republicans and 76% of Democrats favored gradually raising the retirement age from 67 to 68. Maybe you were talking about one more year. You floated that out there. You got pilloried, Pulitzer Prize winning columnists called your idea horseshit, and you retracted it. And you said, okay, give everyone a mulligan. Everyone's allowed to have a bad idea. But I do think if Jill Filipovich were in charge of the Social Security Administration, she'd actually think about that and consider it. But if Jill Filipovich were a writer online, she'd quickly retreat from it, or not quickly. She'd say, okay, this was a bad idea, because you have to. This is just how writing and interacting in the public sphere goes in 2023.
So that's right. I mean, I guess what I would say is that I do think those of us who are writing in the public sphere, even on sort of a silly platform like Twitter, do have an obligation to like think things through and do 5 minutes of research before we tweet things out. And like, I just didn't do that, right?
Okay.
I read two news articles and was like, this seems silly, and wrote a very kind of poorly conceived, not particularly well-researched tweet. So I do think that one is on me. I do think the reaction to it was totally insane. And also should have thought for more than like, you know, 45 seconds about it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think to me, the takeaway from kind of these big pile-ons like that, you know, or how much they do kind of shut down discussion on questions that should be thought through, should be discussed. The kind of economy of social media in particular, right, really does incentivize these kind of big outrage pile-ons. And the outcome of that is that I think a lot of people not wanting to be subjected to that then retreat. And all of the incentives go in the way of supporting not even like what most people want or support, but what a very small group of very loud people on the internet want and support. And I do think that is bad, right? Bad on sort of a variety of measures. Bad for public debate, bad for policymaking, bad for just like interesting ideas and discourse, right? You know, even the Atlantic piece, you know, many of sort of the same loudest people were very critical of it, which is fine. I wasn't putting that out there expecting, you know, just universal applause. But what I thought was interesting is that I got a lot of emails from people who I, you know, really like and respect, saying like, that piece was great. You said what you said was really important. I'm so glad that you brought that. I'm so glad that you said that.
I'm going to cut you off. And then they said, but I could never say that.
Well, and I, you know, I'm not even going to tweet it, right?
Yes.
Which again, like, is fine. I get it.
I knew that was going to happen. That is how it works these days. The back channel, the thank you for saying that, I couldn't. That is omnipresent, and it's not
and
good.
And I've done it too. I've also, you know, DM'd people or emailed them saying that was great. And also, like, I don't feel like dealing with the garbage in my mentions if I tweet this, but like, thanks for writing it. You know, and it's such a tricky thing, because I don't want to say like nobody should criticize anyone online. Of course, it's fine to criticize people online. But I do think this dynamic of the pile on and needing to be the 3,000th person to criticize someone online is not super healthy.
Jill Filipovich is, she writes on Substack under the very entertainingly titled name Jill Filipovich. And she also writes for The Atlantic and CNN.com. And as I mentioned, her last book, which she was on the Gist to talk about, was OK Boomer, Let's Talk, How My Generation Got Left Behind. Jill, thank you so much.
Thanks, Mike.
And now the spiel. A few years ago, New York judge Arthur Engoron was speaking before a community college class in Queens. He was asked, does the media affect what you do? His answer.
There occasionally have been reporters in my courtroom. I had some high profile cases involving taxi service in New York and the use of a park in New York. No, it wouldn't affect what I do. It shouldn't, and I hope it doesn't.
That may have changed today when a high-profile defendant by the name of Trump, Donald Trump, sat before the judge and glowered. The judge himself gave half a smile to a camera allowed in the courtroom, which a commentator on Newsmax referred to this way.
As we look at this image of the judge, I've never seen anything more inappropriate in my life of this judge being, you know, smiling like the cat that got the canary here.
Again, Engoron literally took off his glasses and smiled and shrugged, a gesture that took, I timed it, 3 seconds. I've gotten to know the judge, remotely, at a remove, via his weekly project of writing an alumni newsletter to his old high school. It's not a fancy high school, it's a public high school on Long Island. I didn't go to this high school. My friends who went there says, oh yeah, Art, that guy's great, he writes the alumni newsletter every week, and it just keeps everyone in touch. I read some of them. You know, we all have this guy from our high school. Listen, you say, I am glad he does it. I could never put together the alumni newsletter, but you know, it's a great thing and we're all bonded and keeping up with everyone else because of it. This may be your person, maybe Nancy or Steve or Aaron, Wiz or Scooch, the big wazoo, whoever. In the case of this one Long Island high school, it's Judge Arthur Engoron, who the former president says should be disbarred, and whose Trump's defenders really, really don't like. Their vehemence was obviously provoked when the judge ruled last week that Trump committed fraud by inflating the value of his assets, and he's already stripped the former president of control over some of his New York properties. This displeased Trump as well, who let everyone know it today.
This is a judge that should be disbarred. This is a judge that should be out of office. This is a judge that some people say could be charged criminally for what he's doing.
Nobody this side of that angry Newsmax commentator thinks the judge should be criminally charged. And yes, 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 the authoritarian playbook includes criminalizing the legitimate pursuit of legal consequences. So it's not that Trump's outburst is simply a temper tantrum to be brushed off, but it is a temper tantrum, and it does seem quite likely the court will brush it off. Trump called New York Attorney General Letitia James racist. He made some other points, unusual for a defendant, even in a civil matter. But Trump's an unusual defendant whose interests are other than the establishment of innocence. That's done. That's gone. He can't do that. He's doing the best he can with a losing legal argument. In fact, maybe the knowledge that all of his legal entanglements help him in the polls put him in a mindset other than, well, I've got to figure out the best way to play a bad hand. Maybe his mindset is more like, I actually need these legal entanglements to propel my electoral chances. Courting a contempt of court order, knowing that his followers use contempt as fuel, it could be in the Trump mind kind of savvy. Or maybe he can't help himself. I am genuinely interested in the question of who was victimized in this civil case. Yes, I know. It seems clear he fraudulently stated values for his businesses that were not backed up by fact. Former accountant, one who served time in jail for his role in the scheme, was the first to testify today. It's illegal. It's falsification of records. But I do wonder how often other similar actions are prosecuted. Trump and his lawyers argue no one was harmed. His business got loans. The banks that provided the loans got paid back. The grand march of commerce continues apace, and an ends justify the means theory isn't a legal theory. And with Trump, everything is always justified if it helps Trump. All that's true, stipulated, but I think it would still be interesting to be able to point to other similar precedents and say, no, Donald and defenders, you're not being singled out. Tutwillinger Industries also faced a huge fine for this, or Peripheral Associates LLC got in major trouble back in the 60s for the same, but I can't find that. I haven't found that. I haven't seen that. I'd like to know if that's true, just as a rebuttal or not a rebuttal. You know, sometimes Trump's, well, he's not right, but in a limited way, some of his points are less preposterous than others. It would be nice to know what category to put this in. The no one really got hurt. Falsification is but a process crime rather than a crime of real victims. But legally, he's cooked. He seems to be, in this case, cooked. He's not going to jail. He will face a fine. The question of how cooked is a question of degree. The fines could amount to $250 million, which is significant, or by the estimates of net worth provided by his old accounting firm, merely chump change, with whoever buys that argument constituting the chump. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara produces The Gist, but Joel Patterson really banged out the production today as The Gist's senior producer. And what a looming montage. The Gist's chief lobster officer is Michelle Pesca. The Gist is presented in collaboration, close association with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. Do you wish to advertise on The Gist or know someone who does? Go to advertisecast.com/The Gist. Umpru, G-Pru, Du-Pru, and thanks for listening.